Hello, and welcome to Fire on the Prairie, the monthly radio show brought to you by In These Times magazine.
On this show, you'll hear from Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Sanders just announced he's running for U.S. Senate in 2006.
Despite huge increases in productivity and the technology, the average American worker is worse off today than he was 30 years ago. And I think it's important that Congress and the media begin focusing on that reality.
In These Times editor Joel Blyfus caught up with Sanders at the National Conference for Media Reform in St. Louis. We'll also bring you two readings from an event at the Harold Washington Library called Invisible Labor, How Art Speaks the Language of Labor. You'll hear writers Jeff Manis and Susan House share their prose about work.
Also on the show, Aaron Sarver interviews In These Times contributing editor Celia J.A. Talvey about the state of the prison industry today. First up, Joel Blyfus talks with Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has been Vermont's lone member of the United States House of Representatives since 1990. Sanders identifies as a democratic socialist and has fought for the rights of middle class and working people while mayor of Burlington, Vermont, and throughout his tenure in Washington. In These Times editor Joel Blyfus interviewed Sanders at the National Conference for Media Reform, where Sanders' speech inspired a standing ovation.
You are considering a run for the U.S. Senate. What kind of leadership would you bring to the Senate?
If I'm elected to the United States Senate, I think it's fair to say that I will be the most progressive voice in the Senate and will continue doing the work that we did in the House. My major emphasis will be on economic issues and addressing what I consider to be the collapse of the middle class, the fact that despite huge increases in productivity and the technology, the average American worker is worse off today than he was 30 years ago. And I think it's important that Congress and the media begin focusing on that reality, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the increase in poverty, our disastrous trade policy, the fact that we're the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't have a national health care program, increasingly regressive tax structure. So those are some of the issues that I'll be talking about, and talking about very loudly.
How do you think you're going to be doing this differently than other senators? I mean, there are some senators who have brought up parts of this, perhaps. What are you bringing that's going to be different?
It's obvious that, you know, one person or five people or 10 people in the United States Senate cannot do it alone. What we really have got to do is bring about a fundamental political change in this country, change political consciousness, focus on the reality that many working people are voting against their own economic interest because political leaders are not speaking to those issues and to the interest of working people. The goal is to form a new relationship between grassroots America and Washington, coordinate activities, and let what I think the vast majority of people want is economic justice in this country and not a government run by the very, very wealthy. So it's going to take a lot of work. It's not going to happen overnight, but that's my goal.
Why do you think the Senate never talks about issues of economic inequality, debates trade policies?
That's a very good question, and the answer is quite sad, and that is that to a very, very significant degree, Washington is controlled by big money interest. I can document for you exactly the people who pay for legislation that comes on the floor of the House, you know, whether it's the so-called energy bill, which is paid for by the coal companies and the oil companies and nuclear power companies, or whether it's this obscene repeal of the inheritance tax, which is paid for by billionaires, or the bankruptcy bill, or whatever it may be. Big money has unbelievable power in Washington. They control the debate, especially right now, where you have an administration that works hand in glove with the wealthiest people in America and the largest corporations. So I think there is a timidity, sometimes a fear, that if you speak up, they're going to throw huge amounts of money against you. I've been dealing in opposition to the pharmaceutical industry for many years. I was the first member of Congress to take constituents over the Canadian border to expose the reality that in Canada people pay a fraction of the price that we pay for prescription drugs. There are a number of other people who have been doing that, and they have been slapped around by the pharmaceutical industry, which has limitless sums of money to put into campaigns. So I think people are terrified of standing up to big money. because they'll be punished at the through campaign advertising and at election time.
Over the years, you've developed a strong base among working people in Vermont, a base that's ensured your reelection. How have you done that, and what advice would you give to other people running for office?
Too often, people on the left look at cultural issues as the most important issue. And I happen to think, given my background, I grew up in a family that did not have a lot of money, so these things are maybe, you know, pretty natural for me. The reality is today that there are tens of millions of people who are struggling hard just to keep their heads above water economically. So people who have no health insurance, so they're paying much more they can afford for health insurance. They're desperately trying to get a decent education for their kids. They're scared to death about what their pension is going to be there when they retire. And to a large degree, we've ignored those people. We've ignored those people. And I think it's important that we reach out to them and understand that we know what they're going through and that we're going to change the system. It is not acceptable that America is the only country in the industrialized world without a national health care, that we haven't raised the minimum wage in 10 years to a living wage, that we have a major crisis in affordable housing. People spending, you know, people say, well, there's homelessness. Sure, homelessness is a big problem. But what's a bigger problem is that millions of people are spending 50% of their limited incomes on housing. How do you have money to do the things you want to do? So the point is, the middle class, it's collapsing. It's about time that someone started talking about those issues.
From what you said then, I would assume that you think the Democrats could have run a different type of campaign in 2004?
You know, it's easy to have 20/20 hindsight. Frankly, I don't think that Kerry ran a terrible campaign. Obviously, they made some mistakes in not responding to these vicious lies about his record in Vietnam. The problem with John Kerry's campaign was John Kerry's record. That's the problem, and there's nothing you could do about it. For example, I am absolutely convinced that if John Kerry had voted against NAFTA, if he had voted against permanent normal trade relations with China, John Kerry would be the president of the United States today. So he came up with some, you know, thing, well, we can't give tax breaks, blah, 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 to companies that are going abroad. The real issue is our trade policy. He voted the wrong way. So if, and of course he was not alone on those things. Bill Clinton gave us NAFTA. But I think, for example, that the trade issue is a huge issue. It's a huge issue not only because we are losing millions of decent-paying jobs, it's not only because we're seeing the conversion of our economy from a General Motors economy to a Walmart economy, but what we're also seeing is the betrayal of America by these large CEOs whose companies have become enormously wealthy and profitable on the backs of American workers and consumers and are now selling us out. I talk all the time, and we're doing a report on this. We're going to be quoting the CEOs of large corporations in terms of how they feel about American workers. And we have Jeffrey Immelt, who's the chairman of General Electric, saying, when I look into the future of General Electric, I see China, China, and China. So for years we were told how terrible communism was and how, oh, we have to be anti-communist. These guys, they love China. They love authoritarianism. They love the ability to pay people 30 cents an hour and send them to jail if they stand up for a union. Who's talking about that issue? I'll tell you a story. I get on Fox Television for whatever reason every now and then. And they made a mistake the last time I was on Fox Television, and they allowed me to talk about trade. When we got back to the office the next day, I don't remember how many we had, you know, 40, 50 emails came in. 95% of them went, I'm a conservative Republican. You're absolutely right on trade. Bush's policies are a disaster.
If and when you're elected, are you afraid of being sort of red-baited?
Afraid of being red-baited? I'm being red-baited already. I mean, that's all the word. Suddenly this word, everybody in Vermont knows that I'm a democratic socialist. But usually, I mean, it's so well-known, no one talks about it. I am an independent. I always run as an independent. But suddenly all over the media now, it's socialist, socialist, socialist. And believe me, what they will be talking about, I'm sure if I'm elected, it will be the Socialist Democratic Caucus. That will be the name. Of course they're going to red-bait. You know, the Republican Party is so bankrupt in terms of ideas that they have nothing to say on health care, on the economy, on education, on the environment. So all that they can do is engage in personal destruction. So do we expect that? Of course we do.
What is the role of the media in sort of setting the public agenda?
The reality of people's lives are not reflected in the media, and therefore people then begin to question their very existence, whether they are the only person in the world who is struggling hard. I think the result of that is to think, well, it must be my problem. It's not a political problem. I must be the only person in America working 50 hours a week without health insurance. That leads to depoliticalization of the nation. So the media plays a huge role in deflecting attention away from the reality of American life And that is the most important issue that I see with regard to corporate control of the media.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah.
That was Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders being interviewed by In These Times editor Joel Bleifuss. To read more about Sanders, pick up a copy of the June 20th issue of In These Times or visit inthesetimes.com.
Writers Jeff Manis and Susan House shared their writing about work as part of a panel discussion at the Harold Washington Library in Chicago titled Invisible Labor, How Art Speaks the Language of Labor. The panel was co-sponsored by the Public Square and the Neighborhood Writing Alliance.
For 27 years, writer Jeff Manis worked in the steel mills of Indiana. Manis now writes about his experiences in the mills and the daily lives of ordinary people. His weekly column called Salt appears in the Lowell Tribune Cedar Lake Journal. Here's Manis reading his piece, Appalachian Apologia.
This one's called Appalachian Apologia. He worked the mines. He spent 2 years in the Army, part of it in Korea. And Korea, he figured, was colder than Kentucky. And after the war, he returned home but did not stay. His people told him of big money up north, near Chicago. He took a job in the steel mill, was placed in the coal handling section of the coke plant. Good job for a hillbilly. And he figured it was not so cold as Korea, but top a coal bridge on an East Chicago January day, it was colder than Kentucky. And the coke plant was a pistol, and it would hurt you if you let it. Same as Kentucky or Korea. He was an old timer when I come in, and he reminded me vaguely of the character actor Ben Johnson of the Westerns. His voice and his face, vaguely like Ben Johnson. But his hair was snow white. His hair was not always white. There was a day when it was black as coal. Woody and Amel told me so. And he had a set of black market false teeth, and they clacked, and he was proud of the teeth. And he was the first man I met at the coke plant, because he showed up for work an hour early every day. And we sat and stared at each other, and he said, "This here place is a pistol." And he was a white man, American born, who could not read or write yet. He'd pick up a stray newspaper and peruse it thoroughly in the presence of the new hires. And Woody and Amel would stare over the coffee mugs and shake their heads silently. He told lies. He told ridiculous whoppers. And it was kind of funny and kind of sad because he was so ignorant and he thought we believed him. But if you did dispute one of his tales, he'd get riled. He was an ignorant hillbilly. He was a liar. Most days you could only see the whites of his eyes and his false teeth. The coke plant, like a coal mine, was filthy. He smoked humps, non-filters, and when he couldn't smoke for fear of fire explosion, he chewed plug tobacco, Bloodhound, Brown's Mule, or Day's Work mostly. And sometimes he'd bring back corn liquor from his native Kentucky, but I never saw him drunk. And he was the last man to wear a respirator when the government finally enforced it. And he washed his tools in benzene, a byproduct of the coke plant, and he didn't wear gloves while he washed the tools. And he ripped asbestos insulation from pipelines so he could demo them with his torch. And he preferred a number 6 tip in the torch. And he used it like a bazooka. He ate head cheese at lunchtime, and the white bread of his sandwich would be black from his alligator hands. And he showered faster than anyone I'd ever seen. And he rubbed powdered hand soap all over his body, and he used it for shampoo on his white hair. Hand soap was free. He was civilized, and he was uncircumcised. And even in his later years, the old boar head remained a grunt out in the field. He was plagued with hernias and a bad back, telltale signs of a bull worker. And a chunk of his arm was missing the size of a woman's fist from where he got it caught between a conveyor belt and an idler. No dead man switches in those days. With hands like emery cloth, he'd pick up chunks of smoldering coke and light a cigarette with them if he thought you was watching. And I watched him bring a small sledge down upon his hand with everything he had, yet continue hammering on a coal chisel as if it hadn't happened, because I was watching. He was a show-off, and he was unsafe. And he worked in the mill with those that was different than Kentuckians, men and eventually women of all shades and colors that spoke with all kinds of accents, but he lived in the hillbilly part of the city. And his sons took dope and sold dope and stole cars, and his daughter dressed like a harlot and wore occasional black eye because she went out with boys like her brothers. And she had babies, and the old man turned 65 in the mill, and he raised grandchildren in his modest slab home in Black Oak, Indiana, USA. And Woody was visibly shaken. He nodded toward a corner in the change house. Woody could only whisper the first name of his old workmate. And the old man lay on the floor next to the toilet, his face a bluish gray like a buffalo carp. And on the stall wall surrounding the toilet, someone had carved, "Jesus Mendez can kiss my fucking ass." And someone else let us know that Jesus Christ is Lord in magic marker black. As more of us showed up, we picked the old man up and carried him down the stairs because the ambulance driver needed help, except for Woody. As we neared the ambulance, I thought of how the old man had pronounced such words as ambulance and sirene and how he'd sounded like Ben Johnson, vaguely. And just before they shut the doors of the ambulance, I touched his hand and it felt like amber. And one of the bosses said if we didn't get back on the job, he'd dock us. Woody didn't care because he was visibly shaken. And management said the old man died at St. Cat's, so his wife would only collect half the insurance. And we passed the hat, and I gave $20 for the widow. I washed my hands of it like Pilate. How can I help an old woman trying to raise grandchildren in a hillbilly part of the city? And he was of the common herd, and he was unlettered and unkempt and for the most part unwept. When his time come, it was nothing so horrendous or glorious as being blown up or burned up. When I hear millionaire ball players whine or think of St. Jude in Lost Causes, I think of him, vaguely. He were a good man, and he never retired. He went and died on the ship.
That was former steelworker Jeff Manis reading his piece, Appalachian Apologia.
Susan House is a former welder and a teacher with the Neighborhood Writing Alliance in Chicago. What follows is House reading her piece about Christmas time at a factory.
There were two things I could always count on in the factory. Sometime close to November 1st, the office would post its annual anti-decorations memo in all caps. There will be no holiday decorations this year. Anyone hanging decorations will be punished. This is a place of work. I also knew that the following week, most of the women would start hauling in decorations and stashing them all over the factory. They would hang them the day after Thanksgiving when most of the bosses weren't back to work yet. It was that way every year, our very own tradition. From Thanksgiving until Christmas, the garlands would droop from overhead pipe to exhaust duct to electrical conduit, multiplying by the week. Fuzzy strips of red, green, and silver alerting even the heathens like me to the upcoming holiday. To me, the coolest thing about the garlands was that they didn't just hang there. They grew and changed color. By the time the company let us have our half-hour Christmas party at lunch on Christmas Eve, the tinsel garlands were about 6 inches in diameter and mottled gray. In the month they hung there, they'd gotten fat and dulled down some. Now, I love this for two reasons. I get fat just that easily, and being in the factory tends to dull me down, too, and it's good to know I'm not alone. What fattened up the garlands was the greasy dirt and fibers in the air. The holiday garlands worked as a de facto air filter, sort of like the ones the company said it couldn't afford to install. So what all this means is that around Thanksgiving every year, I would become thankful that the air I'd be breathing for the next month was going to get progressively cleaner until a special Christmas miracle happened. Almost safe air to breathe at our little party. Thank you.
You just heard Susan House reading at a panel discussion titled Invisible Labor, How Art Speaks the Language of Labor. J.A. Talvi is a contributing editor to In These Times magazine. Talvi recently went undercover to report on the American Correctional Association Conference for an In These Times cover story. As Talvi writes in her latest article, prison populations have soared. In 1980, federal and state prisons incarcerated 316,000 people. By 2000, the number had surpassed 1.3 million. Aaron Sarver sat down with Talvi between panels at the National Conference for Media Reform to discuss the U.S. prison system here and abroad. Talvi began by talking about the rising number of incarcerated women in the U.S.
One of the things that people don't realize is that we've reached historic highs in the number of females in jail and prison. We've exceeded 100,000 in state and federal prisons. We're up to about 180,000 if you include jail population. And what's striking about this is that we're not just locking up women, which in and of itself is amazing to think that we have women in these kinds of supermax conditions when they're locked down 24 hours a day with no human contact, with no showers, with cold food. And I've walked through these facilities. They're screaming, they're yelling, they're medicated, they're drooling. I mean, it's Orwellian. It's absolutely unbelievable. The amazing thing about these women is that they, most of the time, have children on the outside. Depending on the state, 50 to 90% of the women have children on the outside. And these children, as we're now finding out, are being locked up themselves. They're being locked up in juvenile facilities and then later in adult facilities. So we are guaranteeing intergenerational cycles of crime and of incarceration. That is, in essence, the formula that we've laid out. And it's for this reason, for many others, that I've focused on this area. It's also that we don't understand what it means to be a woman who starts to commit crime and what it takes for, and this is not to say that there are essential gender differences, but just socially speaking, what it takes for a woman to actually start living as an outlaw, it means she's usually gone through tremendous trauma. And again, that's backed up by studies. We find that most of these women have gone through tremendous sexual, physical, and emotional abuse. And that's, you know, that's a crisis. And that's a situation for us to be looking at and to really be cared and concerned about. Much of it has revolved around that. And also girls are getting locked up at earlier and earlier ages. I've talked to some 11 and 12-year-olds, for instance, in the King County Juvenile Detention Facility, and just watch these girls look absolutely bewildered. They're children, and they're living their lives in cells.
What are the circumstances under which 11 and 12-year-old girls are incarcerated?
Oftentimes, it's truancy, extended periods of truancy. I have actually met girls who are already turning tricks at that age and who are using drugs at that age. And their parents don't know what to do with them anymore. Oftentimes, of course, those parents themselves are drug abusers or living lives where they are working two or three jobs and aren't allowed or able, rather, to supervise their children. And it's just tragic, and that's how we need to look at that.
Can you talk about the exporting of private prisons to Iraq?
Yeah, there have been some interesting parallels in that. I think a lot of what we've seen in Iraq, and for that matter, Afghanistan, as well as Guantanamo Bay, you know, we've perfected the art of imprisoning and torturing people, and then we've taken it abroad. People think of Abu Ghraib and they think of it as being some kind of an aberration or an exception to the rule, and in fact it's just more of the same. It happens to be in some cases a little bit more extreme, like in the case of the man who's being electrocuted, the famous photo in The New Yorker with Seymour Hersh's article, and that kind of thing. Arguably, I've never seen that before in a U.S. prison. In truth, yes, there are private entities involved. What we've done also is to take people out of our prison system who were very experienced wardens, prison guards, and when I say experienced, I mean also questionably experienced, sent them over there to, in essence, let them set up the shop. And they did so in a manner that didn't surprise me, which is to say they did so pretty horribly and with torturous effects for the people being incarcerated. One of the interesting things about going undercover, when I went undercover to cover the ACA, American Correctional Association Conference in January, was that one of the workshops actually was run by the man who had set up the civilian side of Abu Ghraib. And the stuff that he showed us, we actually watched a slideshow for an hour of images from Abu Ghraib and from many other prisons, was alarming. We saw juveniles, 12 to 15 years old, simply clad in their underwear, packed 15, 20 to a cell. I saw, for instance, one image that was particularly troubling to me of a man who was covered in blood, who had slashed himself multiple times, obviously indicating that he was either suicidal or very mentally disturbed. And when the colonel, who showed this photo, brought it up, he laughed. He laughed out loud and he said to the crowd of correctional officers and wardens, and you know what this is. We see this all the time in our prison system. This is just someone who wants to get attention, and we know better than to take it seriously. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we're exporting.
Why don't you think Democrats have used not only the booming prison population in the United States and the detrimental effects of that as an issue, but specifically Abu Ghraib and what we've seen happening in Iraq as in a campaign issue?
That's a damn good question, and I'd like to call them on that, and I do call them on that. Actually, the only person who I can think of right now, and there are a few, but Bernie Sanders out of Vermont has been insistent on the issue of Abu Ghraib and us actually not only examining what's happened there, but really taking a look at where those orders came from. We've been very content with targeting and sentencing the people who were the officers who actually committed those atrocities, and as well they should be. But the truth of the matter is those orders came from high up. There's no way you can look at that objectively and not figure that out. Sanders has said, look, you know, when this first happened a year ago, we said we've got to find out how this happened, who made it happen, and, you know, a year has passed, and now we're just very content watching Grainer go to prison, watching England, the female sergeant, be tried, and as you know now, she's not being tried. The truth of the matter is Democrats find it politically convenient to ally themselves with Republicans in this regard. It's still viewed as being politically advantageous to be, quote-unquote, tough on crime, and the fact of the matter is that we need to take our leaders, our Democratic leaders, to task on this. This is no longer effective on a social level, on a political level, or on a fiscal level.
You've just heard an interview with Celia J.A. Talvi. To read her work on the web, visit inthesetimes.com.
Thanks for joining us for this month's edition of Fire on the Prairie.
This show was produced by Aaron Sarver and Emily Udell in Chicago. Thanks to Joel Blyfus for contributing to this month's edition.
To contact us or download episodes of Fire on the Prairie, visit fireontheprairie.com.